Subcommittee on General Government meeting this morning, public hearing on the construction contractors board. And we have with us Mr. Craig Smith, the administrator of that board. And without further ado, welcome, and let's get underway.
Chair Jensen, members of the board, my name.
Before you begin, may I ask, you're the ones that send out these things to the LFO?
Yes.
Could I ask if you could send me copies of these electronically?
We can. We'll do it.
Would you do that for me, please?
Yep, very good.
Thank you.
We'll do that. Again, Chair Jensen, members of the committee, Craig Smith is my name. I'm the administrator of the Construction Contractors Board, and I'm here joined by Kay Erickson from Budget and Management Division. Today we're here to discuss the Construction Contractors Board budget. I have a presentation folder in front of you. It has this cover sheet on it, and you also have the agency's budget document there. It looks very similar. I'll be using the presentation document to start with, and you should know that it has a table of contents just halfway into one page. It talks about the agency's mission, its history, the performance measure review. We'll go through the agency's programs, the reduction packages, and the program policy packages. Most of you are aware of the Construction Contractors Board. It's a state agency that was created approximately 1972, was then the Builders Board. It progressed into the Construction Contractors Board a few years later. On page number 2 of the presentation is a brief history of the major events that occurred to this agency over the last 30 years or so. I'm on page 3 and 4 now. The major activities of the board include educating contractors and consumers, licensing construction contractors, of which there's approximately 45,000 today, enforcement of the licensing law, and resolving disputes between consumers and contractors. On page number 5 is the major programs and target groups. Of course, the programs are related to those services. They are an education component, educating both consumers and contractors, a licensing component, which includes a customer service unit that answers phones and handles matters over the office desk, and then a rather unique dispute resolution program designed to resolve construction contract disputes in the field. Our funding source, as you likely are aware, is other funds. Comes predominantly from license fees. License fees for construction contractors are $260 for 2 years, about $130. It's a moderate fee compared to other states. On page number 7 and 8, you'll see a history of those fees. In 1997, the fee for a general contractor for 2 years was $260, and today the proposed fee for 07-09 is that same amount. We have a flat fee structure. We didn't used to have that, but we found that a flat fee, in other words, charging every contractor the same amount, was more administratively efficient. Cost, obviously, is not a huge barrier to entry, and we're able to service our clients, we think, in a more efficient manner by having that flat fee structure. Performance measures summary is on page number 9. We had some action over the interim wherein we sought to improve those performance measures. The first performance measure was deleted. It has to do with customer contacts. Didn't seem to be an effective measure, so it is recommended for deletion. In accordance with Progress Board and others, the advice was to then renumber all of the existing measures, and so there is actually 2 measures. Number 1, the second measure, number 1, has to do with dispute resolution services and the education program, trying to determine whether or not the education actually prevents folks from going bankrupt. That is another measure that was sought to be less than perfect, and so that has been revised through the Joint Legislative Audit Committee review during the interim. Measure number two is the percent of homeowners who are aware of their rights and responsibilities in the services of CCB. We believe that's very vital. If consumers don't know what they can do to protect themselves, don't know about the state services, they can't prevent those problems. Measure number three is the percent of law violators or offenders who reoffend or recidivate. We're having some difficulty with that particular measure. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Measure number four is the percent of licensed contractors operating in Oregon that fail to pay final orders of the board. And we have a pretty good rate of compliance with agency orders. Approximately one-half of 1% of all contractors licensed fail to pay board orders. Of course, most of them don't have orders at all. But of the ones that that are required to pay consumer damage, most of them comply. Measure number five is an efficiency measure, the days to close an enforcement action. We have two major components in the agency. One is dispute resolution. Think of that, if you will, as civil lawsuit. Very similar to filing a lawsuit against your contractor. The other is the enforcement. If you could think of that as police trying to enforce various laws that govern contractors' behavior, that's the enforcement program. There are a lot of possible violations under Oregon law, violations of the contracting statute. That's what the enforcement division does. Primarily, however, they're engaged with trying to stop unlicensed activity. So the days to process an enforcement action is an important performance measure. Measure number six is the average days to issue a dispute resolution or contract dispute final order. You'll see that takes a considerable length of time. We're looking for ways to reduce that, and one of our policy packages will address that issue. Number seven is whether or not folks believe that we're a fair and impartial dispute resolution program. That's the percent of parties who see the CCB as fair and impartial. We have good performance there. Measure number eight is the percent of contractors satisfied with the agency's processing of license information. Contractors, again, with about 45,000 contractors licensed, half of which renew their license or obtain a new license every year. So 24,000 contractors, if the agency doesn't do their job right, that's a barrier to entry. And at this present time, we've got about a 1 to 3 day backlog on processing those applications, and that's what the industry needs. Item number nine is the statewide percentage of customers rating overall satisfaction with the agency. You will have seen these, of course, with your other agencies that you've reviewed. We're going to talk a little bit about the agency's performance. That is seen on the following page, on page number 12. On page 12, you'll see the graph of how folks answered that question. In this case, we asked that question of licensed contractors, every person who got a license during the quarter that began with April. I believe it was April 1st last year was asked that question. What was their overall satisfaction, their timeliness, accuracy, helpfulness, experience, and availability of information? You can see the results there. 93% for the overall satisfaction with that particular service provided by the agency. Moving on, key budget drivers and environmental factors. I think it's important to know that if I can, with your permission, I'll right inside the front page of the presentation folder, you'll see a graph. And this perhaps is the best way for me to explain to you what's going on with this particular industry. And this is a graph that combines rate of increase in licensed contractors and the filing of complaints against contractors. The green line, the scale is on the right. You can see that for the last couple of years, we've had a steady increase in the number of licensed contractors. The red line is the enforcement actions, unlicensed contractors, if you will. And the blue line are contract disputes. when I discuss the budget drivers, I think this is probably, again, probably the best piece of information I can give you. The amount of licensed contractors continues to go up as our economy heats and the demand for housing increases. So on the document that I've shared with you on page number 14, we indicate the economy is a huge driver, obviously, for our budget. It's the population growth, the inward migration of folks into the state that drives demand for housing. Similar issues that drive the budget have to do with the confidence that consumers have in state agencies, with CCB particularly, or not. And when they have confidence in the state, they demand services.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Polizio.
Good morning. On this chart, what explains the seemingly large spike of the enforcement files in, you know, sort of the October 05, November 05? It doesn't look like there are that many. Well, what's going on there?
Sure.
But what happened? It looks like an exciting period.
Chair Jensen, Representative Polizio, it's a good question. Thank you for it. This really doesn't show the demand for the services in terms of the complaints being filed, but rather shows complaints that are open. And we had some staffing issues, in other words, retirements and backlogs that resulted in complaints not being opened in a timely manner in a couple of areas. So that's what what explains those spikes. If you drew a line from the first data point in July 05 to the current data point of March 07, it's a fairly steady increase. That really is the trend, although we have opened up complaints, what looks like spikes. That really is the result of staffing inconsistencies rather than demand for that service. Other demands or the other budget drivers include what the construction industry demands. Their cost and availability of liability insurance, as you're aware, has been an issue over the years.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Thompson.
Might as well get right into it. I've sat in the same budget now for four sessions, and every year I hear it's a problem, and every year I hear you guys are in a leadership role finding a solution. What's the solution?
Right. Chair Jensen. Members of the committee, the question, of course, goes to what are we doing about this insurance problem for contractors? And as you may know, there was a task force, a legislative task force over the interim called the Task Force on Construction Claims. They worked diligently. They used a lot of CCB money trying to find out what the problems were with insurance and claims. And there are recommendations that are coming to the policy committees. Matter of fact, we have two up this afternoon. We've had several. I think I've got a seat with my name on it there in the Consumer Protection Committee. Bobby there. And so I think part of the answer, Senator Johnson, is some additional regulation, more accountability for contractors. We're not dealing with any form of tort issues. However, obviously, it's the complaints based upon bad work that generate insurance claims that drives up the insurance. So can we reduce the complaints by increasing regulation? I think that's where we're headed at this point.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
But the dilemma that I'm hearing from my contractors, and I'm sure my colleagues are too, is you force us to have insurance, and you drive us into a marketplace that is hostile or non-existent. And I'm just trying to figure out how that works to keep a vital industry in this state going. And I guess I'm not satisfied with an answer that says lots of tough problems, we're still working on it. I've now served here since 2001, and it just seems to me as though nothing has occurred except the frustration of the folks you serve continues to rise. And I didn't hear in your answer any specifics that need to be overcome. It seems to me that if you need additional people or there are budget elements that would try to get to a solution, that this would be the forum to try to make that case, because I just don't know how long the industry can continue to go caught between a rock and a hard spot, the state forcing them to have insurance and none available.
As a response, Senator Jensen, Representative Jensen, Senator Johnson, it's been suggested that we drop the insurance requirement, allow the marketplace to set that. That certainly is a solution that was that's occurred in California and in other states. Oregon, as you probably know, is one of the few states that requires insurance. As I understand it, there's not an appetite to drop that insurance requirement at this time. But that's certainly something we can take a look at down the road. I can tell you that we survey every licensee to ask them, what are you paying for insurance? How's it going? And the screams from our licensees have lessened.
Really? Yeah. Good.
So I think part of it is that they're finding ways to shop for insurance now that they didn't have 2 years ago. Insurance is still costing more. But it's in some cases it's quite high for construction contractors that build a lot of homes in the neighborhood of hundreds of thousands of dollars. But for smaller contractors, they can get insurance at the rate of $10,000 to $20,000 if they build 5 to 10 houses a year. But that cost goes directly into the cost of new housing.
Thank you.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, that would start our review then of the program.
Senator Winchett. Thank you, Chair Jensen. Sir, in a way that begs the question for the small contractor, in that if he has to come up with $10,000 or $20,000 for an insurance premium before he can start working, it becomes exclusionary to the small businessman. How are you dealing with that, sir?
Chair Jensen and Senator Witz, it's a problem. Your question is, how do we deal with it? We do what we can to try to help applicants shop for insurance with a partnership with Department of Business and Consumer Services, DCBS. We have created something online where a contractor can put their zip code, the type of work they do, and get a list of insurance providers that they can go shop with. We think that helps. We work with the Home Builders Association, the Remodelers Association, and others. There is precious little that we can do, however, as, of course, the insurance industry is not regulated by us. And the mandate for insurance is a statutory one that, again, I think there's an argument that can be made to relax it, but that argument has not carried the day at this point. That's a good segue into the first program that we have with the Construction Contractors Board. That's the Contractor Education Program. And I was thinking of a way to try to talk about how CCB regulates construction contractors. There really is a couple of different models when it comes to licensing law. One is the model that I think the best way to talk about it is your driver's license. Driver's license, you have a relatively simple test. You have it early on in your career, 16 years old, and you never really get tested again. Throughout the remainder of your driver's license career, you have to maintain insurance, and that license can be taken away from you. But the model is relatively easy test and then financial responsibility. And as long as you drive all right, your privileges are maintained. That's what you've had with contractors for the last 25 years or so. You had no test until the year 2000. Since 2000, we've had a modest test requirement. But contractors have been required to have liability insurance and a surety bond. Surety bond is really the insurance to make sure that they take care of their bad work. And it is the better, if you will, of taking out the bad apples. Because if a person has bad credit, bad history, they can't get that surety bond. So that's what we've done in contracting. Since that time, and this year is a great example, we have had some push to educate contractors more. There are bills before policy boards this year, or policy committees, that will require continuing education of contractors, that will require additional competency testing of building envelope contractors, and that's where the state's headed today. I can't tell you that's neither good nor bad, but I can tell you that we're in a model at this point of requiring more regulations of construction contractors to maintain a license over and above what we've had over the years. The contractor education program for CCB involves the writing of a manual. I brought that manual in case anybody would like to see it. We produce this manual with help from the outside world. It talks about how to be a good business. What are the regulations? What's the DEQ regulations? What are the building code regulations? How do you stay out of trouble with CCB? What about insurance? What about accounting? What about taxes? Perhaps the biggest problem today in the construction industry besides insurance is, frankly, contractors working without properly covering their workers with workers' compensation coverage. That drives legitimate contractors crazy. They expect the CCB and workers' comp to do something about that because their competition, when they don't have that coverage, is beating them in the marketplace. Education providers teach the course in this book to about 500 applicants a month, new folks who want to join the ranks of the construction contractors. There are about 500 to 600 applicants a month that get a license. We have an advisory committee, and then there is a test. The test is conducted by a private vendor. The cost for the test is $160. But precious little resources, again, I think it's new. It's ever since the year 2000. Precious little resources at the agency have been devoted towards contractor education. We have a staff level of one. Approximately 1% of the current budget for managing the vendors that have to do with the manual, the testing vendors, and the education vendors. We do have a performance measure. It's not a key performance measure, but it's another performance measure wherein we ask every person who takes the test their satisfaction level of the education program, and at this point we enjoy a fairly high level of satisfaction. This gets us into the performance measures review. The first performance measure on page number 17 has been recommended for revision. Without talking too much then about that, I would like to talk about the one on 18, which is the new performance measure. This is the percent of CCB-tested contractors that have filed or have final orders to pay damages that remain unpaid after 60 days. It is new. We have some historical data. We don't have much in the way of explanation at this point, but we understand that that this is the direction that the Assembly would like to go, and perhaps after this budget season we'll have more information. One of the best ways to regulate is to not have problems in the marketplace. We can resolve a lot of construction contracts. We can penalize unlicensed contractors. But if consumers don't know what to buy, where to buy, how to buy, and they choose to buy from unlicensed contractors or to use extraordinarily poor contracts with unlicensed contractors, we're not going to be able to save all those souls. I've seen literally construction contracts that consumers have brought to us after they say they've had a problem that were written on the back of a brown paper bag. I've seen consumers tell me that they chose the unlicensed contractor because they thought they were saving money. They probably were, but it's obviously a short-term savings and a long-term cost. So consumer education is a vital part of the CCB's program. It makes up, again, a very small amount of the percentage of our budget, but we think it ought to make up more. And we're looking actually for some program improvements here. We'll talk about those in the packages yet to come. Consumer education. We measure our outreach on consumers with a performance measure. It's performance measure number two. you can see that on page number 21, we have some aggressive targets. We're hoping that 60% of the population will understand their rights and responsibilities and know about the services of the State Contractors Board. We measure that through a random sample survey once a year, and we're not there yet. We need to do a better job. We did get some good news here in January when we discovered, I think partly because of some media attention we've had with the task force and some other issues, that about 40% of the population know about the CCB. So we need to improve that. The next program is the one that you'd think of probably most when you associate the Construction Contractors Board and contracting, and that's the simple process of licensing a contractor. Licensing sounds pretty simple, but it really is a little more complicated than that because we don't license people. We do license businesses, and there's a lot of requirements to have that licensed business with CCB. We need to identify the business, make sure that they're actually legal with the Corporation Division, identify the people who are associated with that business, the human beings, make sure that they don't have unpaid construction debt, ensure that someone in the business is taking the test and pass the test, that the business has its proper tax numbers, has workers' comp if indeed they're going to have employees, has their bond, has their liability insurance, and all of those things can change on a monthly basis, on a daily basis. And we keep track of all those records. Obviously, one of the goals is to ensure that of the 500 new contractors every month, those new contractors aren't responsible for unpaid debts. And that is a large portion of the work that goes into the licensing program. Those records are maintained in our database. They are used by thousands of Oregonians every day. Our website can get between 1,000 and 3,000 requests for information every day. Not only consumers, but other construction businesses, insurance companies, policymakers, and others are interested to know whether or not a contractor has a license today. And our database is maintained twice a day so that accurate records regarding the license status of a contractor is maintained for the public.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Edwards.
Thank you. Are there restrictions put on licensing for unpaid debt, like child support, things like that? I mean, does that get into this realm as well?
Chair Jensen, Representative Edwards. It's a great question, and we do have relationships with the child support folks so that monthly we receive requests. I believe they come from DOJ at this point, asking us to suspend a contractor because that human being owes money for child support, and we do that.
Thank you.
Excuse me. The licensing section, the current resources, just to give you an idea of where the money goes, on page number 23, the resources to operate this section are 17 staff, uses about 25% of the agency's budget, so about a quarter of every dollar in fees goes to maintain this program. There's a performance measure. It's performance measure number 8. Again, we, in this case, enjoy a high level of satisfaction with the folks that we serve with this program. That is contained on the graph on page number 24. We're doing well. We want to keep it that way. We're a little concerned with some of the policy packages coming up. There'll be some fiscal impacts with those policy packages. We want to make sure that as we increase regulations on this group of folks that we're able to process those regulations and those pieces of paper so that we don't create a bottleneck. I should tell you, and I've told other folks this in the past, that sadly, 6 years ago or so, we had a backlog of 90 days. It took 90 days from the time you filed for your contractor's license before we were able to give it. And that's obviously not acceptable. It drives a lot of different problems, but today we've got that down. We want to keep it that way. So we don't have any policy packages in this program. It's running pretty well. Takes us to our
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you. Craig, you said that your backlog used to be 90 days, but you didn't set, and you said you got it down. What's it to now? So if a person applies for a license, what is it? I mean, how long does it take to get a license?
It's a great question, Chair Jensen, Representative Cromwell. It's a matter of days. If a person walks into the counter, they get it that day, that moment. If they mail it in, it may take as long as 3 to 5 days. One of the biggest issues in the construction industry, obviously, is all they want to do is build houses. They want to just build houses, try to provide services.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Cromwell.
Craig, I apologize for breaking in here again. You mentioned that if a person walks into the counter, they get their license that day. Is it set up that they can come in, take the test is graded, and they can obtain their license? Is that how that works?
Chair Jensen, Representative Cromwell, not exactly. The education that a person must take is usually done at home. In most cases, it's DVD at home. It takes a couple of days to do that. If they want to schedule a test, they can't schedule it until after they've taken that education, and they have their certificate showing that they have taken that education. Once they have their test taken, the biggest problem is getting their bond and insurance in order. But an individual who has their test taken, their bond and insurance in their pocket, their application fee and their application, can walk in to the contracting board, and we're able to give them their license that day.
Is follow-up, Mr.
Follow-up.
Is there a background check for licensees?
Chair Jensen and Representative Cromwell, there is a background check of sorts. Your current statutes allow the agency to not give a license to businesses that have had certain criminal convictions. It's imperfect. The statute's imperfect because in many cases a business corporation, an LLC, for example, can't be convicted of a crime. Human beings that are associated with that business can and have been, and the current statutory scheme doesn't allow us to look past that corporate entity or that LLC. We're looking at trying to fix that. That's among some of the amendments to task force bills that we have over in the Consumer Protection Policy Committee. So from time to time, however, we do receive applications where they've checked the box indicating that the person applying is a sole proprietor and they've been convicted of a crime, in which case we'll do a criminal background check and determine whether or not that particular criminal activity should disqualify them from licensure. We also take a look at more than just criminal activity. The biggest thing we're looking at is are these individuals, have they been suspended in other states? And we have a national database we look at for other licensing boards. And we take a look at their CCB history. In many cases, these individuals associated with new applicants have had long histories of maybe multiple companies. And we take a look to find out whether or not John Smith has been a member of an LLC or corporation in 1990 that has an unpaid debt. That takes time, takes energy, but that's what we do.
Okay. Thank you.
Again, what construction businesses want to do is make a profit. And the thing that drives them nuts is the amount of government regulation that they pay attention to and burdens them, but their competition doesn't. And whether it's licensure with CCB or workers' comp or other regulations, there is a large expectation that if CCB is going to require licensure, that we're going to make sure that the people they're competing against are also have the same burden. We're able to process about 200 complaints a month for license violations, contractor law violations, but there are 44,000, 45,000 contractors probably a significant number of unlicensed contractors and tens of thousands of construction sites going on every day. So we have a demand for enforcement activity that's probably not being met. We're going to talk about that a little bit in the policy package. Today we don't have people out in the field fully trained. We recently hired some limited duration individuals that will be doing some job site checks. We have 9 compliance officers in-house that write administrative orders and do penalties and suspend licenses. But we need to do more out in the field to satisfy the need for of contractors to ensure that they don't get the idea that in order to compete, they also have to cheat. We're looking for additional resources for enforcement.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with regards to compliance, if a person is unlicensed and they are working as a contractor, whether it be as a sub or as a general, if you hear about that person, can you put a stop on their work?
Yes.
Do you have the authority to put the stop on their work? Do you also have the authority to enforce the fact that they don't have a license and compel them to get a license?
Yes. Chair Jensen, Representative Cromwell, that's exactly correct. We don't use it very often, but we do have statutory authority to stop a job site or stop a construction project on site. There are several different things that encourage contractors to be licensed. One is possibility of a $5,000 fine from CCB for every job they do. So we have that. We also have relationships with local building officials, and the statutes require that in order to issue a building permit, you have to check to see whether or not that person asking for the permit is licensed or not. Also have in the statute a prohibition to use the court system if you're an unlicensed contractor. So if you're an unlicensed contractor and you get into a contract dispute and you don't get paid, the court system will not help you. But that's a lot of incentive. Nevertheless, there's still a lot of folks out there working, and perhaps that's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem that we see is contractors choosing to hire workers under the table, and that's just a killer for a legitimate business who's paying the significant costs of employment for bona fide employees.
Seems like we've talked about this topic before.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Senator Johnson.
Would it be possible to actually create a scenario whereby, where you're asking for permits, you have to show a license or demonstration that you're licensed, not just that you have good relationships with some guys? Or did I misunderstand you?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson. Yes, building officials actually have to verify that a contractor has a license before they give a permit. The permit shows who the contractor is and lists their license number. And, of course, using computers, they're able to check that day if they choose to make sure that they have a license. I can't tell you they all do that, but they have the ability to. And we're talking about changing the law so that it's required.
What kind of encouragement, follow-up, Mr. Chair, what kind of encouragement would you need to make that happen?
Chair Jensen and Senator Johnson, an email from you wouldn't hurt.
Cool.
So,
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
How many emails do you want today?
So,
yeah, would you like one from me, too?
So that does bring up kind of a follow-up question then, which is, one of us at the table here decided that we wanted to do some kind of work on our house, a remodel project, and we need a permit. If we went down and got the permit, but we're not licensed contractors and don't intend to be a licensed contractor, so would we then be giving the city officials the name, for example, of the contractor that we're going to use, and maybe their license number, or that they would then check with that person to get their license number, or check the database, but there's some way to verify that yes, in fact, Smith Construction is in fact licensed, bonded, all that stuff.
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell. The way it works today is that if you're an owner builder, you're going to build your own home, you can get a building permit. That's the way it ought to be. But you do have to sign a form down at the permit office that indicates that you understand what you're doing. You understand that you're taking a lot of responsibility on your own. Again, it's a statutory requirement. It's a form that CCB produces and provides at no cost to building officials. Promises that if you use contractors that they'll be licensed and that you'll indicate what those licenses are.
So, if I may, Mr. So we don't necessarily have to disclose at the time that we're getting the permit who the contractor is that we're going to use, but that if we are going to use one, we're basically saying they will be licensed, et cetera. Okay.
Yeah, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. On the black market labor under the table payments, does CCB have an opinion, or could you develop an opinion on how the contractors who are participating in that activity could be identified, specifically on help to be identified on their tax returns?
Chair Jensen and Senator Whitsitt, want to make sure I understand the question. Are you asking if we find violations, can we notify Department of Revenue? Is that your question?
Well, that would be a good question. The question that I asked was that, do you have an opinion, or do you have a, can you form an opinion on how the that activity could be identified by the Department of Revenue, whether it be a software program, whether it be a ratio of labor to materials to total cost? I mean, is there some rule of the thumb that you could help us to identify that?
Yeah. Chair Jensen and Senator Whitsitt, we have given this some thought. I don't know that there is a way to do that. I think that this is a problem that can really only be resolved by having boots on the ground, if you will, investigators that go on the job site and do what our folks are being trained to do, which is to identify the worker, ask who they work for, then follow up to make sure that the contractor that they work for actually has workers' comp, and if they don't, then to properly discipline that contractor. We had a case here about this time last year, where a local contractor just doing a small, modest remodel, going to do a siding job, and the contractor been in business for a long time, 20, 30-year contractor, long-time resident of Salem, and what he did was he underbid. He bid too low. He recognized he wasn't going to make money on the project and started to think how he was going to solve this problem. And what he chose to do was a terrible mistake, cost him dearly. Was he talked to the supply house and asked them whether or not they knew of any installers. This is a siding job. And they came up with some installers. And the installers were just trying to make a living. You know, that's what they do out in the construction trades. But this was going to be paid under the table. And so the installers came to work. I do not believe they could either speak nor read English, and they were required to put the siding on in accordance with the manufacturer's recommendations. I don't believe they knew how to do that. I know that they didn't do the underlayment appropriately. The job was done extremely poorly, and the consumer hit the roof, appropriately so. After all, they checked to make sure the licensee was properly licensed. They didn't have to, they shouldn't have to deal with the fact that the licensee was using underground labor to try to install the product, and the product was installed poorly. But to make a long story short, the consumer ultimately got some redress for the bad work, but the contractor has never recovered from the workers' comp, CCB, other tax issues that occurred because they made a bad choice. And the problem is we catch 1 out of 1,000 of those. But if we can catch 3 or 4 or 5 out of 1,000, maybe we can start to deter that kind of behavior. Right now, I'm afraid that there's more of it out there than I'd like to say. I hope that answers the question. I may not be able to do this through some kind of a computer program with the Department of Revenue. We have a relationship with the Department of Revenue. We provide Department of Revenue, Employment, and others with lists of people that we penalize for not being licensed, and so we do work collaboratively, and we're going to continue to do so.
It strikes me that this is reminiscent of the revenue hearings that we had when we were trying to examine a sticky problem there with uncollected or unpaid taxes. Perhaps if we do have an interim committee, we will remember that we probably want to have the construction contractors board or director be a part of providing us maybe some information on where to go and how to get there on this.
Happy to do that. So with enforcement, for the last 10-12 years, we have had contracts with vendors, private investigators, to do outside work. And that was a pretty good program in the late 80s, throughout the 90s. There are certain things you can do with folks on contract that you can't you can't treat them as employees, obviously. And so that was then, this is now. What we really need now is highly trained investigators that we can train and that we can treat as employees. The vendors, that program has ceased. It stopped about a year ago, and we're looking for full-time equivalent employees to do this work. We do have a package of limited duration individuals that we've put on in the last couple of weeks. They will be available through the end of this biennium, and we're looking to continue that perhaps next biennium, and that's a policy package before you. Performance measures for the enforcement program really are twofold. One has to do with whether or not people reoffend. And that is on page number 27, that's the recidivism rate. We're not happy with our targets here. We think our targets may be way too low. Recidivism in the corrections field, you may know, is around 30%. And we've picked a recidivism rate of 5% here. Our performance measure doesn't show that we're reaching the 5% mark. In fact, it's well above that. So I think we're going to have to adjust our targets and maintain our enforcement program and continue to catch reoffenders, but probably be satisfied with something less than a 5% recidivism rate. Days to process those enforcement complaints, on the other hand, has been a good performance item. We can see we're well under the target amount. Recent staff increases have helped with this performance measure, and we're proud of the fact that we're reaching our goals here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wetzel.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. And going back to the previous performance measure on recidivism, it would appear that, you know, through 01, 02, 03, you were right in the ballpark of your 5%, right in the ballpark of your target. And then in the last 3 years, you've gone south completely. Could you discuss why?
It's a good question, excellent question. And it gives me an opportunity, Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsitt, to tell you that I fear that the results in the 2001, 3, and 4 area were a result of our less than stellar ability to catch the reoffenders rather than actually deterring them. So by not having an aggressive outreach program out in the field, even though we didn't catch them, doesn't mean they weren't there. So because this measure is based upon the agency's ability to catch people, if we're actively catching them, it looks like it goes up. And of course, in the criminal justice field, you've got a little bit more robust system. as you provide additional resources, if you choose to do so, with enforcement, this may go up even more. But I don't think that's a bad thing, because I think we'll be catching more of the offenders, and ultimately that'll start to deter the illegal activity. That's my best explanation.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
In your investigations, do you target those folks who have got outside your rules and your regulations before?
Yes. Chair Jensen, Representative Whitson, the question is, do we go after the people who we've hit before? We keep an eye on them to the degree that we can. We respond, for the most part, to questions from the public regarding whether or not someone's licensed or allegations of illegal activity. If we get an allegation of a person who has reoffended, there are several names that are high on our board, we do put more resources. But we don't have enough resources to go after the person that we hit once back in 2005 who may have their doors open again somewhere. So if your question is, do we keep an eye on every person we have hit with a penalty in the past, the answer would be no.
In relationship to Senator's question, I'm wondering how much of what's appearing in this graph is also a consequence of the economy. As I look at the dates on that, where this is low, we happen to have been in a fairly severe slump as far as our economy is concerned, and of course in the 05-06 years, and starting even before that a little bit, the economy rebounded. And one of the things that rebounded pretty vigorously was home construction, remodeling, et cetera, type of thing. So just simply more activity out there. And I don't know, you know, how it is in other places, but it strikes me that one of the variables where one might use an unlicensed contractor is on projects or on work that you want where the licensed contractors are not readily available, where they're pretty well saturated with their work, and your wife gets a burning itch to spend some of the money that you've carefully guarded and put away, and nobody is there to do it. But I would be curious about the relationship of this variable and the economy. It just seems to me, as I first looked at it, I just thought it was a pretty natural sort of thing with the way the economy has gone.
Chair Jensen, I think there is some truth to that. I think as there is disposable income out there in the community, that raises the demand for construction, and that raises the possibility of people working without a license.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
I think that there is a correlation between the availability and the aggressiveness of enforcement folks. I'm hearing from people that are looking at some of the natural resource agencies, particularly forestry, that it looks as though we're making great progress with respect to people complying with the Forest Practices Act, and really it has to do with the number of inspectors that are available, enforcement folks.
Yeah.
That concludes the review of the performance measures for enforcement. Takes us on to the Dispute Resolution Services Program. Again, imagine this as kind of an enhanced small claims court type of filing where consumers and others file complaints against contractors. It helps keep their feet to the fire, whether it's the 50 or 60% of the complaints that we get from consumers or the other 40% of the complaints that we get from material dealers and other contractors claiming that a general didn't pay them. That ability to file a complaint against the licensee with the state tends to keep the questionable contractors more in line. And, of course, we'll process those complaints, whether we do it with our own people and use the folks at the hearings officer panel, or folks choose to go to court. If they prevail in a hearing, we'll order the contractor to pay. If they don't pay, we'll take their license away, and we'll refer the contractor payment to the bonding company. We have a couple of policy packages for your consideration today as it relates to dispute resolution. As I indicated, perhaps this is a unique, somewhat unique program in the United States. Most states don't do this. What consumers and contractors like about this program is our on-site mediation, where we'll send a representative from the state trained in mediation to the kitchen table of the consumer, sit down with the contractor, and try to hammer out a resolution. That's relatively low cost compared to everything else we do. Hearings cost a lot of money. Processing a complaint and a file takes a lot of money. But sending a person to the house can sometimes resolve the dispute within an afternoon. And to tell you the truth, it's successful half the time. And that's where we get our biggest kudos, both from contractors as well as consumers, is you sent somebody from the state. They helped us work it out. We've written a contract, and now we're going to get our job completed. So that works out very, very well. We have two problems. One, it takes us about 90 days to get that person to the job site. It's a long time. The other problem is from time to time we have individuals who have a very difficult time dealing with the bureaucracy. They're elderly. They're confused. And in some cases,
oh,
they...
Oh, wait a minute.
It's 35 and above, Mr. Chair.
And, of course, nobody here on the committee or the staff here, so... But
you don't have to be elderly to not handle bureaucracy very well.
Or to be confused.
So when that occurs, and when we're dealing with an individual who doesn't have the skills to go through the system, and if that person's been ripped off, we don't have the tools necessary to hold that contractor accountable. That one falls through the cracks because we rely upon the homeowner to work their way through the system. So for a very small amount of situations where it appears as if we can provide not an advocate, but an assistance person to help them with getting their estimates, to help them with complying with the requirements of the bureaucracy, we'd like to have some additional resources for that. And we think we can do that in an efficient manner. Not a lot of them, maybe 100 a month, I mean 100 a biennium. More on target is...
How many of them do you never hear about?
That's right.
Excuse me for interrupting in your thing here, but a little question with this. How much, if any, I mean, since you brought the topic up with the elderly, I'll pursue along with that line. How much, if any, have you done with various... senior advocates or advocacy groups kind of try to get them prepared or get them to help with some education in that particular community?
Chair Jensen, we do have our consumer education outreach folks, and it's in our plan. One of the items we do is we contact senior groups. That's more on the front end, trying to make sure that seniors know how to hire and stuff.
It's a lot easier to stop it on the front end than it is to correct it once it's taken place.
Exactly. And on the back end, we don't do much currently. This package would help us with that back end.
Mr. Chair.
Senator, Representative Edwards, sorry.
So the dispute resolution services program, is it safe to assume that most of those cases really involve end consumers, not disputes between supply houses or general contractors and subs? Is that a fair assumption?
Chair Jensen and Representative Edwards, the numbers are about 55-54% homeowners though about 54% of the complaints we get are directly from homeowners. The other 45% are what we call non-owner claims. About 30% are material dealers. And the other 15% are a combination of employees and business, other, you know, generals versus subs, subs versus general type complaints.
Follow up. So are the homeowner complaints more likely to utilize the dispute resolution services, though? I mean, I understand the breakout in percent of complaints, but which category of complaints uses the most of those dispute resolution services? I'm imagining that a general has being educated in the trades is going to have a little bit more of a hammer to work out a dispute with a sub, and vice versa, you know, just from word of mouth, not working for them again or not hiring them again, stuff like that.
Chair Jensen, Representative Edwards, you're right on target. We don't even use the mediation services for those business-to-business problems.
That's good. Thank you.
So we're looking for a couple of additional FTE for, and that's in the budget package, the 100 that'll be before you a little bit later.
Without getting into the rest of your budget, and you know, I all the line items in it, you know, I do have the pop here for that. How much of your existing budget? What do you have in terms of personnel, et cetera, for dispute resolution?
Great question. On page number 30 in your pack in front of you, Chair Jensen, members of the committee, you'll see towards the bottom third of the page says current resources.
Okay. Got it.
Okay. So.
Yeah.
Performance measures have to do with the percent of licensed contractors operating in Oregon that fail to pay final orders. We talked about that a little bit early on in this presentation. We have a target of half of 1%. Right now, kind of a combination of all the different services right now working with CCB, the licensing, the enforcement, and the dispute resolution, we're enjoying a fairly high compliance rate. So it's significantly less than one half of 1% fail to pay those orders. Another important performance measure is the length of time it takes to process these complaints. This performance measure on page number 33, our performance is not adequate. Our targets are probably overly optimistic. These targets were chosen back in 2003, really before we instituted some additional bureaucracy to the system. That bureaucracy is a claim filing fee and a notice requirement on the part of the consumer, both of which add length of time to process these complaints. So these targets probably could be adjusted. We continue to look for ways, however, to resolve these disputes quicker. The policy package we just talked about, the additional resources, the fast track approach to dispute resolution may also help bring this down.
I note in looking at that chart on 2003, it has about the same type of curve that we talked about a moment ago.
The next performance measure on page number 34 has to do with the how folks feel about their dispute resolution experience with the CCB. This is the percent of parties who perceive the process to be fair and impartial. We'd like to make everybody happy. Oftentimes when it's a dispute that has to be resolved through adversarial means, in other words, a hearing, we're going to have a winner and a loser. So we can't make everybody happy, but if they think they got a fair shot, if they think that the state was impartial, that's obviously vital. And we're enjoying a fairly high performance with this measure. That would conclude the programs. We have the 10% reduction options there for your consideration, but perhaps given the amount of time, you'd like to go into the program packages.
I think so. We're, we were 5 minutes late getting started this morning. To make up for that, we're going to quit 15 minutes early.
George has
for me.
Sounds good to me. Well, we were just talking about the dispute resolution, and package number 100 is the dispute resolution enhancement. Here you would be investing about $300,000 in two positions. You can see how we've outlined that. There'd be a fast-track process for a few hundred folks per biennium, and then we'd have a consumer assistance for elderly and others to help them through the process. What I can say is that it would, we believe, help with our processing time to take. It takes to process the complaints. We believe it would shave 1 or 2 days, maybe 5% off by the end of the 2009 fiscal year. We think it
Senator Johnson.
If I could interrupt you for just a second, it would make it easier for me to listen to you and absorb these if I knew two things. The source of funding for your policy option packages and whether or not these policy options have been through any kind of an advisory board process and gotten the okie-dokie from such a body.
Chair Jensen and Senator Johnson, regarding the last question first, with me today is Chuck Crump. Chuck is a public member of the Construction Contractors Board. The board itself, obviously, is a policy board. It has reviewed these policy packages and has voted to support them.
And follow up, Mr. Chair. Based on some work that Senator Morris and I did last session about best business practices and best governance practices for the boards and commissions, the meetings were publicly noticed. There was an opportunity for the public to come and speak, because some of this is fee, I'm sure.
Yes.
I'm trying to get a sense of, was it on a 4-5 vote, or was it a consensus? Was it? I'm just trying to get a sense for the forum in which this was discussed, whether or not the contractors that pay the fees and are served by your agency felt as though they had been party to the decision making, and the board exercised all the good governance about notice and publicly taking a vote, and it's all recorded, and so it would be safe to say that the construction contractor community knew about it and knew what the board's activities were.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, that would be correct.
Okay. And is all this fee driven?
Yeah. Senator Johnson, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. I'm a little confused here. If we look at the 10% agency reductions, the first and second are investigation and regional enforcement and special investigation. And then when we come to our first pop, it's you need more investigator mediators. There seems to be a disconnect there in my mind.
Chair Jensen and Senator Wetzett, I agree with you. When an agency is trying to put together, what are you going to cut? If you have to cut, you got to try to find modules that you can cut. These contracts are such modules. They made sense to us. If we had to cut, this is probably where we'd go. We think that it's not a wise idea to cut these things, but this is an exercise, obviously, that's required by the budgetary process to indicate what we'd cut if we had to. We would recommend that you don't cut any of that.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up. So, yeah.
So that indicates that somehow that would indicate to me that the only place you can cut is in the most useful positions that you have. I mean, I'm at a loss to understand that scenario.
Chair Jensen, Representative Whitsitt, we have not had any of the regional investigators on contract for over a year. So if you cut them, it would not significantly reduce the service level. One of the reasons we haven't had them on for about a year is that their performance was so bad. We think that this job can't be done through contracting out.
So, in essence, this is a is an excellent cut because, A, they're not there, and, B, they're not any good if they are there. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Jensen, that'd be, Representative Jensen, that'd be one way to do it.
Can I kind of pile on here? if they were that bad and you had a contract with them, did you have any recourse under the contract to get any of your money back?
Yeah. Chair Jensen and Senator Johnson, we did look at that. It's a rather complicated problem having to do with independent contractor law and employee law and the contracts in general. The bottom line is that we did work with general counsel to take a look at what we could do. The wisest, most prudent behavior was to allow the contracts to expire. They did. And since then, we have gone with limited duration employees, and we're hopeful that they'll do a better job.
And follow up, Mr. Chair. I don't buy it. And don't assume that the independent contractor stuff is so complicated that we won't understand it. So why don't you do a little bit better job of explaining to us how it is you got caught with a contract that was so bad that you now have to add FTE and you didn't get any redress under the contract?
Okay. Senator Johnson, with your permission, I'm going to hold that question over and ask the department to bring that to us first thing tomorrow.
That'd be fine.
And my reason for doing so is I'm about to adjourn the committee hearing and for today, and my reason for doing that is we have the Republicans have a caucus that I'm supposed to be at. So,
Mr. Chair, could I ask for one more thing?
But of course.
A legible copy of priorities.
You're in violation of the American Disabilities
Act.
Yeah,
they're fine.
Okay, we're adjourned.